Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
After these things, God tested Abraham. God said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." He said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac said to his father, Abraham, "Father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." He said, "The fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "God himself will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided.
The story you just heard Matt read from the book of Genesis is considered one of the classic texts, and one of our kitchen tables already met before worship, and I've already been given the word. They can't wait to hear what Linda's going to do with this. So, we'll see. According to the New Interpreter's Bible Commentary, this passage has captivated the imaginations of many interpreters, not just myself, drawn both by its literary artistry, the way it's formed, just as a story, and the depths of the religious parts of it. The story's played a really special role in both our own Christian tradition as well as the Jewish tradition, and it has a name, two names really, in the Jewish tradition. You heard Matt say one. The story's called The Binding of Isaac, or the Akedah. I think I've said that right, Akedah. And I'm going to use those terms kind of interchangeably throughout. So I just wanted to say, when you hear me say Akedah or the Binding of Isaac, I just mean the whole story. But this text also presents us with some pretty great problems and hopefully gives us some deep concern. In fact, psychoanalyst Alice Miller claims that this very story may have contributed to an atmosphere that makes it possible to actually justify the abuse of children. That's not good. And her assertion is grounded in the over 30 artistic representations of this story throughout centuries and centuries of art. We're just going to show you one, but two of Rembrandt's paintings. In those paintings, Abraham, the father of Isaac, his hands are covering Isaac's face, and Abraham faces the sky rather than his son Isaac. Can we see that, Harrison? And there's a traditional interpretation that goes along with that. Can everybody see that? He's got his weapon there on the rock. That's the angel of the Lord. Isaac's hands are bound behind him. You can leave that up there. The traditional interpretation of this story goes like this. God calls, Abraham answers, and sets about to honor God's demand that his son Isaac be sacrificed. Actually, in response to God's call, Abraham answers God three times, saying essentially, "Here I am." Abraham demonstrates his radical obedience in that "here I am" three times to God by following God's request, and at the last minute, God gives a reprieve and doesn't require the sacrifice. That's the angel coming down to stay his hand. The angel's hand is on Isaac's hand. So the whole story is interpreted as though God is testing the faith of Abraham. That's a traditional interpretation. Walter Brueggemann, one of our favorite theologians, writes of this interpretation, and he says, at the beginning, God is the tester, and at the end, when the hand is stayed, God is the provider. And in his masterpiece called Fear and Trembling, Soren Kierkegaard retells this whole story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac by praising his incomprehensible faith and obedience, and he uses this as the basis, Kierkegaard does, for ethical behavior. There's a popular author, maybe you've heard of her, Anne Lamott. She's one of my favorites. And Kierkegaard's retelling of the story of Isaac being sacrificed, she lists that and that book as her main moment to be converted to Christianity. So she's one of my favorite authors. She takes that interpretation as really important to her, and she writes it like this: in the interior silence that followed my understanding of this scene, it was read aloud for her, I held my breath in English class in Marin County. I held my breath for as long as I could, sitting there under the fluorescent lights, and then I crossed over. And I don't know how else to put it or how and why I actively made, if not exactly, what you call a leap of faith. And I left class believing and accepting that there was a God. It made no sense. It made no sense that what brought me to this conviction was the story of a God who would ask his beloved Abraham to sacrifice the child he loved more than life itself. It made no sense that he was willing to do the one thing in the world he could not do just because God told him to. God told him to obey and to believe that he was a loving God and could be trusted. So Abraham did. Abraham obeyed. And I, this is Anne Lamott still, felt changed. So, it feels a little bit arrogant for me to disagree with someone as great as Soren Kierkegaard, let alone countless other scholars who take this same interpretation. But I found some precedents, even from the great philosopher Jacques Derrida, who I'm going to try and make sound sensical. But he has this beautiful book called The Gift of Death, and in it, Derrida, disagrees with Kierkegaard's reading of this story. By denying the transcendence of what would have been considered ethical behavior by Abraham, by denying the uniqueness of Isaac. In French, he would say it in a certain way, which translated means all others are entirely other. All others are entirely other. So that all times, at every decision one makes for oneself, it's actually an akedah. It's actually the story of the binding of Isaac. And to Derrida, Kierkegaard's critique of the ethical, where the ethical is a kind of general consensus that is surrendered to by the individual, is false. That in itself is false. Because at every moment, in every particular ethical response, Derrida says, I am exercising my singularity privileging my own personal, particular choices. And to do so and deny that the other, to do so and deny that the other should have the same right, that's not ethical. So if I'm going to say my stuff is good and right, I can't go around saying yours isn't. See, I sound really different than Derrida. But that's what that means. It also feels really unsettling for me to take on Anne Lamott, because I found such inspiration in her writings, and I still do, and I still will. And she considers this story a key to her faith. But I'm moved today to say with great respect and a firm resolve, calmly, that there's no God I know who would put a parent to the test by seeing if they'll kill their own baby. It's even more flawed to say that this story is set up for God's later sacrifice of Jesus. See, that happens later, and people use this story to say that's why God sacrifices Jesus. In other words, God isn't asking Abraham to do anything God doesn't also have to do later, as if we didn't have free will whether to kill Jesus or not. So, that's a lot. But part of what's going on in your hearing from me is this. Forming our own understanding of the way God operates is really important if we want to be thinking theological people. A person who thinks about God is a theological person. And we're able then to share that out loud with other people, to witness when we have those kind of understandings. So I want to try and unpack my own belief right here in front of everyone today, especially in regard to the nature and power of God. There's a quote, "Power is for the well-being of the community." You may or may not disagree with that. Power is for the well-being of the community. So how would the traditional interpretation of the binding of Isaac hold up to that kind of understanding of power? In what way is the community strengthened by that kind of interpretation? So I'm going to ask you to just kind of hold on to that for a minute. And as Matt said, we hope this worship series, the reason we're doing this on the World Cup, it will help us find faithful ways of responding to these kind of tensions. Because that's a tension, right? In the biblical account, as well as the tension in which we live, and in this case, use our power as men and women, as Christian persons, especially those of us from the United States. And when we're honest, we know that our use of power as a nation and as a religion, it's often done great harm, huge harm over the ages. And we also know, as we live in our own community here and witness to our faith, many of us around our small groups called kitchen tables, just how doing harm and doing good go a lot like this. They're often hard to separate. So we're focusing each week and trying to help ourselves understand these things. And this morning, we're going to turn to the writings of Dr. Mercy Odoyoye of Ghana. It's Mercy Odoyoye who wrote in 2001 those words, "Power is for..." Yeah, isn't she beautiful? Just give me a minute. "Power is for the well-being of the community." And with this understanding, she calls us to distribute power equally, all power amongst men and women, rich and poor, the politically powerful and the economically disadvantaged, for the common goal of protecting the health and well-being of everybody in the community. Keep holding that story of Isaac's well-being right here now. How does a woman born in Ghana in 1933 come to this understanding of power? Well, it didn't happen overnight. I want to just tell you just a little bit about her education. She's a Ghanaian United Methodist woman. She has formal education in education, meaning she learned pedagogy so she could be a professor. and in theology. And she studied theology at the University of Ghana and at Cambridge University in the United Kingdom. And she has served as visiting faculty in other theological institutions in other African countries and in Canada and Europe and right here in the United States. She served as staff to the All Africa Conference of Churches and the World Council of Churches. That's where the whole world sends representation of religious leadership. And she became the first black woman and the second African appointed to the World Council of Churches deputy. That's the highest level, deputy general secretary. And she held that for 9 years until she retired. In her retirement, she's been working tirelessly as well, and she's been the president of many things, theological Christian student federations. One of the most important things I believe she's done is she brought into being something known as the Circle of Concerned African Women Theologians, and it continues to this day. It started in 1989. She established the Institute of African Women in Religion and Culture at Trinity Theological Seminary in Ghana, and she served there as director. And right now, she is working to connect Princeton in the United States, their huge theological library, with Ghana in an online basis. If you ever saw a picture of how few books they have, it's like this big, hardly any books. So she's connecting Princeton's theological library in an online capacity so that people will have access, men and women, to theological education to learn about God in Ghana. And I want, this is not a phenomenal video, but I just want you to see her and hear her voice. This is a small snippet about this project to connect us, Princeton, to Ghana. Can you show, Harrison?
Well, I think it's important for people to support the campaign for the digital library because it's important to support theological education globally because theological education becomes part of the resource that the world needs to understand the other's religion. And understanding the other's religion means peace. I think it's important because for me, theological education is not just for the churches or for people who go to church. Theological education is for everybody, to help the whole community to understand the other's religion, the other's theology, where the other is coming from. It's part of what we need to emphasize if we really want a peaceful world. So whoever has money to promote a resource place for improving our theological understanding of one another should come forward and make the library project work.
Yeah. Just in that little snippet, you hear her use the word other multiple times. She's a tireless advocate for women. Mercy is, and for justice. And while her positions have evolved over the course of her life, she has always stood with courage in the face of a culture that tells women, especially African women, to sit and be quiet. Her life of theological storytelling is summed up in her own words. I'm going to read some of them for you. She said this: African women accept story as a source of theology, and so tell their own stories as well as study the experiences of other women, including those outside their own continent, but especially those in Africa whose stories remain unwritten. That's why you sit in circles of women to hear stories. It's like we sit in circles of kitchen tables to hear each other's stories. These things aren't written down, but we tell each other who we are by listening to those stories over time. Odioye explains how stories informed African women in their reading of the Bible from the perspective of their own cultural understanding. And by interpreting the multi-religious and multicultural context in which African women are living from the perspective of their interrelatedness, different tribes' interrelatedness, Odioye hopes in her work to develop compassion and solidarity amongst all women outside of Africa, inside of Africa, in our struggle for human dignity, and in finding ways to live God-centered and Jesus-like lives for the improvement of all of society, and in practicing and finding hospitality for everyone to come to the table of the Lord. She has evolved over time, I said that. At one time, she expressed her view of male and female relationships. And I love that she's vulnerable enough to say, I've changed over time. And she tells it like this, by sharing an African myth, okay? Here it goes. And Anansi is the trickster, is a spirit of trickster in African culture and in many cultures. Once there lived on earth half and half, each of them only half a human being. They spent all their time quarreling and fighting, disturbing the rest of the village and trampling upon the crops. Every time a fight began, cries went up to Anansi. They are at it again, Anansi. Half and half are fighting. So one day, Anansi had had enough, and Anansi came down, brought half and half together, and a whole human being appeared. Okay. That's how she expressed how she saw male, female on earth. People, half male, half female, coming together. But later, she changed as her own understanding grew. For while the African idea of unity exists, like I just told you, in their culture, and that's an ancient tale that many people would ascribe to, as far as women and men are concerned, in reality, she says, that's a false unity at the expense of both. Domestic and economic violence against women creates a traditionally acceptable but detrimental peace for both the oppressor and the oppressed. And Odioye then recommended, instead of that, a theology of relationships, which would open up new horizons to both men and women to live our humanity to the very fullest that would be possible to any of us. She wrote an article called Women and Ritual in Africa, and in this she finds that traditional African rituals that pertain to birth, puberty, and marriage, so translate that, like we have baptism, we give driver's license, we have marriage. So when you hear those things, I'm hoping and trusting you can understand that all cultures have rituals in our culture that pertain to our lives. So she's saying the rituals for women that pertain to birth and puberty and marriage curb women's sexuality. And they're meant to direct women's biological potency and energy towards male needs, Linda said calmly. She courageously encourages both African traditional religions as well as Christianity to rethink and re-ritualize women's sexuality with insights from women's religious experience so that women might feel both holy and whole. So H-O-L-Y and W-H-O-L-E, whole, in practicing our sexuality. So I want you to notice her shift in understanding of women as half to a woman as whole, in which women's holiness is directly linked to our wholeness, and same as men, as human beings in a liberative and creative way. And that was a very long article, but she concluded it with these wonderful words. Women are persons in communion, not persons who complete the other. We may need to reorient our thinking so that we see communion as a relationship devoid of hierarchical relations and power seeking. When we have learned more about our humanity, perhaps we will also be able to understand what God is telling us about divinity. Just think about that for a minute. She's a courageous woman, Mercy Odioye, who in the face of male-dominated culture firmly critiqued the patriarchal rewriting of history and called for a revisualization. She called for this in the face of her deep desire to heal the problems of her people And she especially accuses Western role players of following false alternatives in both our history writing and how we are as ecumenical, different faiths coming together by ignoring the idea of unity and wholeness. And what she's trying to say by that is missionaries from America came to that country and used our interpretation of Euro-American Jesus and didn't even think that there might have been an African interpretation of Jesus. So the right way to be a Christian already put the male at the top, whether he was or wasn't, already put the woman as different and other. And she challenges us to think about that, and she fearlessly retrieves and fiercely attacks her own country as well, and the patriarchy there. So, all of that is to say, I read as much as I could, and I couldn't find a thing she wrote about this story. However, I believe she would have taken that critique that I just gave and applied it. Because listen to what she says about the status of women in Africa. In Africa, the very idea of a free woman conjures up negative images. We've been brought up in Africa to believe that a woman should always have a suzerain, an overlord, and that she should be owned by a man, be he the father, the uncle, or the husband. A free woman spells disaster, she said. An adult woman, if unmarried, is immediately reckoned to be available for the pleasure of all males and is treated as such. This is not historical writing, by the way. The single woman who manages her affairs successfully without a man is an affront to patriarchy and a direct challenge to the so-called masculinity of men who want to possess her. At least she calls it so-called. And some women want the right to be fully human, whether or not they choose to be attached to men. And this liberation for women must also happen in the church. And that starts with the text, the Bible. So, whose voice did we hear in that story? God, Abraham, and Isaac, right? Last time I checked, Isaac had two parents. Where is Sarah's voice in that story? Where is her voice? It's entirely possible it was there but not recorded because it was discounted, right? It's not that she wasn't necessarily speaking. Isn't the victim's mother in this story important for the plot? Why isn't her voice heard? What would she have said? Would she support her husband or oppose him with all her heart? The silence of Sarah's voice is troubling. Would a mother, knowing that her husband was about to lead their son to the sacrificial altar, not get up at least in the morning to say goodbye? Let alone plead or argue with her husband, with whom she had no power or standing, right? About the foolishness of such a plan. Not to mention that this particular child, Isaac, was so long in coming. He was a miracle. And at such a potential cost to her 90-year-old, which she supposedly gave birth, to the physical health of a 90-year-old woman to give birth. Are you serious? She's not going to say anything? We know that Sarah is not the silent type because she fell down laughing when she found out she was pregnant. She said, "You are not serious." And nor does Abraham hesitate to discuss other matters with her. That's in the record. Although it might have been unmanly to do that, so they may not have wanted to record that. Or maybe he's a sneaky person who has no courage, and he snuck out because he knew if he tried to talk to her, she would take him and say, "Oh, no, you don't. Guess who's going to get sacrificed first?" Right? I mean, come on. It's in the service of patriarchy that we ignore the voice of Sarah. The God that I know would not expect that of us. No way. But we have to remember that this written record received was recreated by those who would have us believe in a world order that puts males on top. And as Mercy Odoye reminds us, we do make a mess of our world when we ignore God's voice, these are her words, and we misuse both the natural order and our human companions in the process of seeking our own interests. So to break free of a world in which half and half make a whole human being, where the natural order means males dominate females, is to be liberated by a loving God to live out our full humanity. See? So, I got to watch her speak, just on videotape. And I would have loved to have shown it to you. You can just Google her name in YouTube, and you'll see her address to the Ghanaian Womenist Conference a couple years ago. And in it, she has a huge poster of a traditional Western bride and groom. And she's going through the wedding ceremony with a room full of women. And so she says to them, you know, in a marriage ceremony, you're asked a question, and the response is, I will, or I do. I will. Will you take this woman? I will. Will you take this man? I will. And here's what she said to them. Will you? Will you take this man to be your husband, to allow him to take your money, to take your savings, to always minimize your own accomplishments every day so that you take a quiet seat? Will you? The room is very quiet, just like now. And she says, say, I won't. And the whole room says, I won't. And then she leads them through it and takes them through all of the cultural norms of those African women, of what they are asked to do when they say, I will, in the marriage ceremony. Now, for some of us to answer, I won't, it's not only not difficult, it's just not there. I mean, Matt and I do have people still that come and say, I'm not going to say I will obey in the marriage ceremony. And we say, it hasn't been in there for a really long time. That's just the movies. But if it was in there, no, I'm in. For some of us, I won't wouldn't be difficult. But that's because we are in positions of power. For some of us, it is earth-shaking and takes great courage not just to live it, but first to even allow ourselves to think that we have a right to say, I won't. For some of us, we don't even know we have a right to say, I won't. And that's why her work is so important. Mercy Odoye is a woman of courage and conviction and knows that for some it means everything. So she speaks to gatherings of women in her home of Ghana in a room to help them say loudly, I won't. And it's one thing for me to say it and for us to know it. It is moving. But it's another, actually, to be in the room with her. And I'm grateful that I have a friend who gets to travel a lot. I have two friends. And I went and asked them both because I thought, I bet they've met her. And sure enough, one had. And as soon as I asked my friend about this, I said, have you ever met Mercy Odoye? She goes, oh, like that. And it was when she was a much younger woman. And my friend, it was in the 70s. And she was part of a youth direction to the World Council of Churches. And she was in a circle of women with Mercy Odoye. And they were having a discussion, you know, just talking. And my friend's a very polite, just a beautiful woman. And Mercy, who she had just met, leaned over to her and whispered to her, do you have your passport with you? She's like, yeah. Yes, I do. And she goes, may I have it? And she said, okay. So she reached in her bag, and they were in Ghana, and she handed her her passport. And then she just kept on talking. It was a group discussion. The discussion was around these questions. How do you find the courage to speak for justice as a woman? Because the women were, like, amazed that Mercy, and this was in the 70s, was, like so courageous and seemed so fearless. How do you find the courage to speak at all, let alone that you're a woman? And then how do you find the courage, like, to speak about anything, because you're supposed to be silent? But then you add that, how do you find the courage to speak on behalf of women here, and then of other oppressed people? How do you find the courage? So that was the discussion, and then they really were laying in on her with that, and she stood up. And she said, my friend said, and there she held up my passport. And she went like this to the circle. And she said just these words and sat back down. She said, the only difference between you and me, and she's looking at my friend, is that you still think you have something to lose. She just sat down. If you believe that God would put you to the test by asking you to do something that is contrary to the grace and love that you all know is for everyone, it's possible that your answer, even unto God, is I won't. I won't. And Mercy says, we vow to you and to all of ourselves before this great cloud of global witnesses, seen and unseen, that never again shall we walk on tiptoe around the globe, which is God's whole world and our whole common heritage. Because what have we got to lose? What have we got to lose? If we're in a position right now where you sit, and you're thinking about coming to this table right here, maybe you feel like you have something to lose. But really, what have you got to lose? And if there is something, maybe you need to let it go today. In the face of God's desire for us to be God's whole people, loving one with another, what do we need to lose, so that we can all come together as one?
All these things that we call familiar are just miracles clothed in the commonplace. And you'll see if you try, in the next stranger's eyes, that God walks round in muddy boots, sometimes rags, and that's the truth. You can't always tell, but sometimes you just know. Some say jewels were made from pockets of tears, trapped away in small places for years upon years, pressed down and transformed till the true self was born, and the whole world moved on like the last notes of a song, a love letter marked without return address. No more.